Welcome to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I am Ray Powell in California, the former military officer. And over there, we see Jim Caruso. He is in Arizona. He is the former diplomat. Jim, how are you?
I am well. I'm not Ray Powell, but I'm fine.
Well, we can't all be Ray Powell.
Thank God.
All right, Jim, who's with us today?
Today, we're very fortunate to have with us two of our fellow, my fellow Bauer Group Asia people. The non-executive chairman of Bauer Group Asia India, Ambassador Alok Prasad, who has a long distinguished career as a diplomat with the Indian Foreign Service, and senior director based in Mumbai, Vaman Desai, and they're going to talk to us about India, only 1.4 billion people to care about. And with all the uproar in U.S. relationships around the world today, we want to ask them, why should we care about U.S.-India bilateral relations? And maybe, Ambassador Prasad, you could lead off with that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on your show. I think I've heard several U.S. presidents say that the U.S.-India relationship is going to be one of the defining relationships of this century. And I think that sentiment has also been reciprocated entirely from the Indian side. I think it's important for another reason, because it wasn't always that close, as we know. It was famously called estranged democracies. And now I think we've come to a phase where we can call ourselves engaged democracies. And as I look around, there's so many areas of, you know, potential cooperation, the possibilities in trade, in technology. I think both countries have the willingness and the resources to be able to really build a very sound partnership in a number of areas. I think I'd also mention the role of the Indian-American community, which in the U.S., which forms a very important bridge between the two countries and brings a more sort of cultural and a personal dimension to the relationship. So for all those reasons, from the geostrategic to the individual level, I think there are a number of reasons why this will be one of the most important relationships in the years to come.
Well, so Vaman, as long as we're, you know, sort of launched out on that direction, of course, there was just a big summit or a big meeting between the two leaders, Trump and Modi, in the White House last month. And the statement, the joint statement that came out afterward was pretty extensive. It was when we look at sort of all of the different meetings that President Trump has had since he came into office, of course, some of them have been extremely tumultuous, but this one seems to have gone pretty well. What's your impression?
Thanks, Ray. And let me take a step back and, you know, give a bit of perspective on the meeting itself. If you look at, the Indian Prime Minister's visit to the U.S., it came within a month of the new administration's swearing in. Modi was the fourth global leader to meet President Trump. And if you take out the Israeli Prime Minister and the Jordanian King, he was only the second leader, and the first being the Japanese Prime Minister. So I think that should give us an indication of the priority to which the U.S. government is setting in its sort of course in the Indo-Pacific region, and both Japan and India being part of, Quad. With this context in mind, and it's also a little unusual for an Indian prime minister to meet a U.S. president so early on in any president's term. So from that point of view, it's a welcome step, I would say. And particularly if you're referring to the joint statement, it was indeed a very, conducive meeting. We did not see any kind of a major disruption in the sense of the bilateral relations and, you know, the strategic and technological aspects of the agreements which were sort of have been built over the course of time over the last several U.S. Presidents. From that point of view, I think it's most certainly a very positive outcome. I think I'd list out four or five, key areas or key takeaways, which came out of the meeting. And of course, we can dwell deeper into that going ahead. One is, of course, trade. Within trade, and the entirety of the trade was laid within the framework, something called as Compact, which is catalyzing opportunities for military partnerships, accelerated commerce, and technology.
So let's, I'm sorry, but I just want to dwell on trade for a minute, and maybe I'll hand it off to Jim here, because he's our economic and trade expert, but trade was a big part of this, wasn't it, Jim?
Well, they have an agreement to negotiate a bilateral trade agreement, which is unusual for the Trump administration these days. But it was so interesting to me that India sells twice as much goods to the U.S. as India buys from the U.S., which is usually a trigger for President Trump. Can I ask you both, why do you think that didn't come up as a big issue and hasn't really been raised since then? Although now we have tariffs on Indian steel coming to the U.S.
Well, I would say that, you know, on the whole, India has reasons to be satisfied from the outcome of the visit, particularly in the immediate context. You know, just that morning, President Trump had announced his decision to impose reciprocal tariffs. And during the campaign, he had often singled out India as, you know, one of the very high tariff countries. So there were some apprehensions. I think the Indian government played it quite well in the sense that they anticipated some of this. So even before the visit, in the budget, they reduced tariffs on several items of interest to the United States, including Harley-Davidson motorcycles and bourbon whiskey. So those were, so they had taken that kind of preemptive action. And then I think they very skillfully, you know, packaged it all into this idea of working towards a bigger trade deal between the two countries. So that leaves some space for negotiations. And I think that was one of the reasons why, you know, the meeting went off as well as it did. I would say that there were no major disruptions, as some might have feared. And in fact, both sides came away with a sense of the relationship not only being intact, but of being enhanced in several directions.
Well, we'll see how the relationship survives all of those Harley Davidsons and bourbon whiskey arriving at the same time.
Let me also make it clear that I think the Indian side clearly understands that it's not going to be a smooth, you know, passage all the way. There will be ups and downs. There will be hard negotiations. There will be hard bargaining. But at least the initial engagements were, you know, satisfactory. And on areas where there will be some difficult negotiations, particularly trade, but also possibly immigration, H-1B visas and all that, they have bought time for these to be worked out and to be negotiated over. So I think that's how I would summarize this.
So when we talk about time, of course, there are a couple of targets out there, and one of them is 2030, and there's this thing called Mission 500. So can you tell me a little bit about Mission 500 and whether you think it is significant or achievable?
Vaman, you want to come in on that?
Yes. Thank you. So let's take a view of the U.S.-India trade relations as they exist right now. I think our bilateral trade in goods and services is valued somewhere around $200. So to get to Mission 500, you're talking about, you know, making it 2.5 times, sort of doubling it or more than
200 billion. So we're going to 500 billion.
200 to 500. Yeah, you're literally sort of more than doubling it, right, over the course of next 5 years. It sounds at the very first sight a very ambitious target. So that's a good thing to set it right at the very first place. But then also, you know, we should realize that the two sides are working towards something called as a bilateral trade agreement. You know, so that is both sides have a willingness to be able to sort of understand each other and sort of come to some kind of a workable mechanism whereby the custom duties would be reduced and that would lead to further acceleration of trade in goods and services. There are other components of the bilateral trade, particularly when it comes to services. India is emerging as the hub for global capability centers. So you're seeing more and more U.S. companies setting up their shops to run their entire operations based out of India. energy is going to emerge as one of the key areas of business between the two countries. India is expected to import at least $10 billion worth more of oil and gas in the coming year from the U.S. Of course, you'll have the defense partnership as one of the pillars. So all in all, I would say, you know, given the trajectory of how the bilateral trade has evolved over the last 3 or 4 years, I think there needs to be a little bit more of an exponential growth. And if not 500 billion, we'll certainly reach somewhere there about, let's say, close to 400 or something like that. You know, it's very much possible to be able to double the existing trade in goods and services. The first step towards that is to able to achieve something called as the BTA, the bilateral trade agreement, which the two sides have set to achieve by the fall.
Let me play the skeptical diplomat here. So first is on energy. We're a lot further away from sources of energy like the Arabian Gulf, not to mention Iran. So it would seem that our energy transport costs alone would make it less reasonable to be the source of energy. Secondly, on defense, this is a huge shift for India, going from primarily Russian-made or supplied defense articles to U.S., which, of course, is also much more expensive, and we require all sorts of new training, or so my military friend Ray would tell me. So how do you think those are going to go?
Well, I mean, I can certainly speak about energy, and Sir can come in on the defense part. Of late, we have seen over the course of the last 3-4 years, there's a growing realization within the Indian oil and gas ecosystem that there is a tendency to, you know, prefer Henry Hub linked gas contracts because they tend to be much more stable and insulated from any kind of crude linked volatility in the market. And hence, you're seeing a lot of emphasis on sort of, you know, fetching for Henry Hub, you know, linked gas contracts in India's, you know, gas importing entity.
Just so people know, Henry Hub is the U.S. price setting mechanism for natural gas.
That's right. The U.S. Price setting for natural gas. So we are seeing increasing emphasis within the India's oil and gas industry. Of course, it remains very cost competitive. You know, India is a cost competitive market. We tend to look for those contracts which work out cheaper. But whatever pricing formulas which various Indian companies have signed up with entities in the Gulf and in the US, there doesn't seem to be much of a difference. It's a very competitive market. The advantage of, you know, signing Henry Hub gas contracts is there's a relative stability from the volatility of you know, the crude related gas market. So we'd certainly see a lot of positives in terms of increasing gas imports. Going ahead, it might not be in the short run, but, you know, in the medium to long run. And it also, you know, goes well with Trump's own agenda of sort of, you know, drilling more gas and extracting more gas from the U.S. So certainly there is, you know, a possibility, particularly to have more gas contracts. And oil as well, you know, if you look at it, the base, you know, of oil and gas imports, which we currently have in the U.S., we have just about 1% of our entire import basket. So the base is very low, and hence the incremental growth can come very fast. So, you know, at what stage does that set in, and at what stage does that mature is something, you know, for the energy analysts to sort of take a deeper look at it. But there are certainly some low-hanging fruits in terms of gas deals, which can be made, long-term gas deals, and some oil deals as well. So you know, we can have that energy basket more from in the U.S. in the coming years.
So, Ambassador, I'm going to ask you about the defense side. Of course, you know, India has a long history, a well-established pattern of buying weapons from Russia. But buying weapons from Russia isn't as easy as it used to be, I wouldn't think. Not just because of sanctions and such, but because Russia is using its weapons in a major war in Europe. And so we have seen a diversification. Do we expect to see an acceleration of that diversification coming out of this meeting? Or was that just going to happen anyway because the Russian arms market is been problematic?
Yeah, well, let me just add a line on the energy side of things. We are already importing a fair amount of oil and gas from the U.S. now. I don't know how energy prices work, what is swapped at sea, and so on. But the fact is that we are importing significant amounts of oil and gas from the U.S. And we expect that to increase from $10 to $15 billion as of now to about double that amount. So they are looking at that as a major component of reducing the trade deficit, which, as you mentioned, is a sort of trigger for this administration in the US. So that is going to be a major component. The other big component is going to be on the defense side. And let me add, as an Indian diplomat, that you mentioned reliance on Russian equipment. It was partly because Western equipment, US equipment, was not available for us. And that has changed over the last 10 to 15 years. And since then, we have already bought about $20 billion worth of US equipment. There is a conscious strategy in India to diversify our defense sources. I think the only new major contract we've signed with Russia in recent years is the S-400 air defense system. Otherwise, most of it is, old license agreements, producing T-90 tanks and Su-30 aircraft and so on. But now, if you look at it, almost our entire transport fleet comprises of the C-130s, the C-17s. We are looking for more of both of those. In fact, we have requested the U.S. government, because the C-17 production line has ceased, whether we can get some aircraft from the U.S. inventory. I think that discussion is going on. The Indian side is very keen to buy P-8I aircraft from the U.S. I think discussions are going on for about 6 or 8 more of the P-8Is. Plus, we have a pending order for Apache helicopters, which I think will also increase in number. Then we are using the Chinooks. So there is a fair amount going on. And that's on the equipment side. Then there is I don't think there are any two countries, I was told, which exercise as much together as India and the US. All four branches of the services, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Special Forces do regular bilateral exercises. In some of these, like the Navy exercises, we also invite countries like Singapore and Japan, what are called the Malabar series of exercises, which have been going on. And there is a technology relationship, an emerging technology relationship, for things like joint production of GE aircraft engines in India, for production of Stryker armored vehicles, infantry vehicles in India. So there are a number of those initiatives, and as I said, clearly the Indian strategy is to try and diversify our sources of defense, and in that I foresee the US to be an increasingly important partner going ahead.
So let me ask you this. Prime Minister Modi's famously hard negotiator, as is Donald Trump. What does Modi want from the U.S. relationship? Is it an offset to China? Is it to increase trade? What's he looking for, especially given India's historic position as leader of the global south and famously non-aligned?
Well, I think situated as we are in the Indo-Pacific, and the U.S.'s emphasis now on the Indo-Pacific, that's obviously one of the areas where we will be cooperating more to see that the Indo-Pacific remains an open, liberal area where all countries can can prosper. But I think the important thing is that, it's not just, a China-driven relationship. I think there is enough intrinsic merit in the U.S.-India relationship on its own. Yes, China is an important factor and is going to be an even more important factor But I think it's not the only thing which drives the relationship. That's the way I would see it.
If I may add to what Ambassador just said on the intrinsic worth of the bilateral relationship, from an Indian point of view, US remains our largest trading partner in terms of trades of goods and services combined together. We have a decent size of Indian diaspora in the US, which is fairly well placed and successful. There is an element of a strategic cooperation to the bilateral relationship. And Ambassador was alluding to, you know, the bilateral relationship in terms of technology. And one of the key outcomes which, you know, we saw coming out of the Modi-Trump meeting was something called as a TRUST. TRUST is an acronym which stands for Transformative Relationship Using Strategic Technology. So it's essentially a continuation of what was, you know, a Biden-era acronym called as ICET, which is Initiative on Critical and Emerging Technologies, essentially covering a whole gamut of technologies like semiconductors, AI, quantum computing, and all these aspects. So this remains, you know, a key component of the bilateral relationship outside of whatever is going on in terms of, you know, US vis-a-vis China and India's role in it. Because India is the source of the largest tech talent in the world. Some of the largest US companies have their presence in India, and some of the largest presence in India anywhere outside the US. You look at the top hyperscalers like Google's, Microsoft's of the world, they tend to have the largest offices outside of the US anywhere in the world in India, where a lot of R&D and all kinds of, you know, activities happen, high-end activities. You also have...
So yeah, just let me jump in there. So one of the lines that came out of this thing on the technology side was something called the Autonomous Systems Industry Alliance. Autonomous systems, or drones or robots, essentially. What is India's position in that industry? Is India leading that industry? Is India driving that industry? Is India catching up? Where is India on autonomous systems?
Well, there's a lot of work going on, not only on autonomous aerial vehicles, which are, you know, pretty commonplace, but also underwater autonomous systems and, you know, sea surface systems. I think that's where a lot of the, you know, future development is going to happen. I might mention that, you know, there has been a lot of discussion about the so-called offer of F-35s. Which the U.S. has made to India. But I think it was actually, you know, cautiously phrased that it could open the door to an eventual, you know, supply of F-35s. I think the significance there is precisely this, that things which were off the table are not off the table any longer. And that shows a willingness on the U.S. side to share cutting-edge technology with India, as we are now seeing with the GE aircraft engines. And this is autonomous systems is going to be another emerging area where a lot of work is going on in India, but it's obviously at a nascent stage. The whole industry is, you know, is fairly nascent. But there is a lot of work and there's a lot of interest in the two countries to work together in that.
So the other thing we're seeing is a lot of manufacturing that U.S. companies had been doing in China are moving out of China, at least for non-Chinese production. Now, some of it's going to India. For instance, Apple, I understand, is doing a lot of the iPhone manufacturing in India. Are you seeing this trend continue? And what are the barriers to doing more?
Very important question, Jim. The short answer is yes. We are seeing this trend to continue and only accelerate from here. You mentioned the example of iPhone, Apple. Apple assembles, it's essentially an assembling unit so far, but it sort of made in India, iPhones contribute to 16% of total iPhones manufactured globally for Apple now. And then there are projections to say that, you know, that will go up to at least twice of that, you know, close to 28, 29% in 3 to 5 years. So you're seeing India being a recipient of some of these companies who are sort of moving out of China for non-Chinese manufacturing, a lot of them being US companies. And the Indian government has realized that this is an opportune time for the country to integrate more into the global value chains, and has sort of also come together with a bunch of production linked incentive schemes targeting 14 to 15 different sectors, whereby it's attracting those companies which are moving out of China to come and set up its plants in India. So you're also seeing companies such as Microns of the world, which are sort of setting up their ATMP, assembling, testing plants in Gujarat. You are seeing, across the space, Amazons and Googles of the world who are coming in here, building, some of the largest data centers anywhere in the world, in India, because of the massive data the country generates due to it being only 1.5 billion people. So you're seeing a lot of technology companies, increasing their, investments and activities in India. And that is a trend which will continue to happen. What I think is the next stage of gain for within this entire supply chain ecosystem is for India to be able to attract companies in other, sources of manufacturing. Let's say, for instance, toys or any other labor intensive manufacturing, which can come set up shop in India, manufacture, and then, export it outside, including in the US. So I think we will see a lot of these, things come up, which will be in mutual interest of the US and India, whereby, India can act as an affordable destination for some of the production for some of this labor intensive.
Historically, the problem has been the so-called license raj, that the bureaucracy made things very difficult for foreign companies. Has that changed?
There's a lot which has been accomplished over the last several years. The perception, the fact that you're asking this question essentially means that the perception still remains that India is a hard place to do business. And the government is aware of the fact of, of this fact. The problem in India is it's a federal country. So a lot of powerful policy levers essentially lie with the state governments and not necessarily the central governments. But of late, we've seen a healthy competition also coming up with various state governments which are vying for investments from foreign companies. So you're essentially seeing a bunch of 7 to 8 states in India which have really sort of, put their act together in terms of land policies, their, industrial sort of ecosystem, logistics, which has been centrally driven, logistics and infrastructure. That has been one of the major success factors for this government over the last 10 years or so, and multiple other sort of policies like, a single source of, clearances for all kinds of licensing and all of that.
If I may jump in, I don't want to interrupt Vaman, and I agree with all that he's saying, but I think you're right. I think if you're looking at the China plus one strategy, India should actually have done much better. And in fact, the China plus one is probably, Vietnam at the moment, Mexico for other reasons. And India hasn't really, apart from a few examples like Apple, I think India has not really been the plus one country as it should have emerged. And I think that is largely because of our internal issues that you referred to, that India is still perceived as a difficult place to do business. I think that is how we are looking at this whole negotiation with the current administration. It's a bigger view than just, conceding to the pressures on tariffs which this administration is putting. It's being seen as an opportunity of where we can reorient, our own system to respond closer, to be part of the, global value chains, and how we can align some of these things, to see it as an opportunity to carry out some of the reform which is necessary for us to reach that target of 500 billion. So I think that is the way it is being viewed as in India, that not just, as a response to pressure on tariffs, but as an opportunity to see what are the reforms we can carry out within our system to do better exactly in the areas that you mentioned.
Well, as a person who was recently denied a business visa to India, I sympathize with the complaints about the bureaucracy. Before we come off of the India-China relationship, I would like to ask you about the border a little bit. Now, of course, last October, Xi and Modi got together and seemed to stabilize at least that tense relationship, or that, you know, often that would come to a violent relationship there up there at the border. But there have been other border issues, and the border issue, even where those that conflict was taking place, hasn't gone away. And there's also this issue of China wanting to dam the Yarlung-Zambo River, which flows into India. So what is the direction right now of the India-China relationship overall? Is it getting better? Has it stabilized? Is it degrading?
Well, it became pretty tense. And as you mentioned, you know, we don't have a settled boundary, but we had a settled border, in the sense that both sides had agreed that they would maintain, you know, peace and tranquility on the border. There were detailed protocols worked out on, you know, how often, you know, patrolling would be done, what kind of weapons they would carry. And, you know, that changed in 1920, when we had this, you know, clash in the Galwan Valley. And since then, troops have been sort of facing off each other in the high Himalayas. Now, our recent agreement has been to sort of disengage from that. It is working relatively smoothly, but I can't say that all issues have been resolved, but the atmosphere is now much better. From the Indian side, we've said that, you know, we cannot have a completely normal relationship until, you know, we restore peace and tranquility on the border. And those discussions are going on with the Chinese, and they are making some progress. On this dam on the Brahmaputra, this is, you know, on that what is called the Great Bend of the river. We are watching it. We were not consulted about it, but we have raised it in our bilateral talks with them, that this should share information with us as to what their plans are, what they're planning to do, how it might affect the lower riparian flows in the river. So these are sort of issues under discussion, and we are watching that closely as to what they really plan to do there.
If I may add, there's also an economic dimension to the entire relationship. And that, you know, within the economic relationship also, India has many concerns with its bilateral trade with China. Of course, China remains the country with which we have consistently, we have the largest trade deficit with any country. And that has happened over the course of last several years. There's also an issue of, the Chinese investments into India and into strategic sector. Indian government, you know, issued something called a Press Note 3 back in 2020, essentially restricting Chinese investments into India through any automatic route, which means every investment coming in from China has to be approved by the government. So there are these tensions on the side of the economic relationship as well. Of late, as Ambassador explained, when we are sort of stabilizing at the border, trying to contain tensions, we have also seen some positive indications of looking for win-win deals with China. The government of India recently approved 6 to 7 investment deals coming in from China, essentially into consumer electronics and other kinds of related ecosystem manufacturing, where any Chinese company which has an Indian joint venture partner, and if that Indian joint venture partner has a controlling stake, then they can come and manufacture. So there are such deals being worked out with China. Of course, things remain in a very nascent stage. And of course, you know, our trade deficit with China continues to be a concern. And that is something which, you know, the government will look to address at some point in time.
All right, I'm going to pull into the 30,000 meter level. So it seems the U.S. is pulling back from its role post-World War II of being the provider of global goods. And is disinvesting from the system that was in place. And everyone's asking, what takes the place? What happens next? India, being a large growing economy, large population, a leader, as I mentioned, of the non-aligned movement in the past. Can India help fill the role that the U.S. is abandoning, perhaps with other countries?
Well, I think to some extent that is happening already, because the U.S. does view India, and India sees itself as a sort of net provider of security in the Indian Ocean region, in our immediate neighborhood, and it's developing its capacities accordingly in terms of, you know, the plans for the for the Navy and what we are already doing with some of the smaller island countries like Mauritius, like Seychelles, even Sri Lanka. So that is a sort of natural kind of burden sharing which is happening. And I don't think it needs to be formalized in sort of any way in terms of legal agreements and so on. But it's a very natural development, and it's happening with the consent and the approval of both countries.
I'd like to ask, in the sense of India working internationally, India is part of two very prominent groupings, which seem to be, which, you know, from the outside would seem to be kind of opposed groupings. One over here, the longer term one would be BRICS, with, of course, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, plus. And then over here on the other side, we have the Quad. Does India look at those two things as sort of two sides of a coin, or is it much more nuanced than that?
Well, I think it is more nuanced. It's, I think as our foreign minister put it in one of these conferences, that India is a non-Western country, but it's not an anti-Western country. And we certainly work closely together in the Quad. We also play a bit of a moderating role in BRICS. As you know, there was a strong push from both Russia and China towards this whole idea of, you know, de-dollarization and trying to replace the dollar is the preeminent currency. And it was India which sort of dampened, moves in that direction. So I dare say that if India were not there in BRICS or the SCO, these would be completely dominated by China. So I think India does play some kind of a balancing role, even in those countries, in those groupings.
Yeah, I'd like to second that. And furthermore, if you look at the history of BRICS itself, it's far more older than the Quad. So in India's, sort of point of view, from an Indian point of view, it's not that these are sort of opposite dimensions of sort of, you know, power, playing, plurilateral forums. You know, these cater to specific requirements of India's own aspirations. And India is in a very unique place. It is, of course, a non-Western country, but it's also a developing country. So the BRICS bloc essentially sort of caters to its aspirations as a developing country. I'd like to reiterate that when the BRICS countries, on the sidelines of the Kazan summit, made some kind of a noise on coming up with a currency which will sort of replace the US dollar, it was the Indian side first, which sort of said that that's not something in our scheme of things. Also because we run the largest trade deficit with China. So if BRICS countries come up to form a currency which is, a competition to the US dollar, then most likely we'll play into the Chinese hands. And that's not in our interest, because as it is, we are having concerns with the deficits which we run with China. So, it's not because of the US that the Indian government will think that, we will not sort of go for a anti-US dollar or sort of, you know, an alternate currency, but India's own interests do not lie in sort of, you know, coming up with a currency which is, you know, counter to the US dollar in a bloc which is dominated by China.
All right, a quick question since you're running out of time. Would India provide peacekeeping forces if there were a ceasefire in Ukraine?
Easy question.
I'm not volunteering anybody.
Fortunately, it's well beyond my pay grade.
All right.
I'm going to ask an easier exit question. Second Lady of the United States, Usha Vance, is a second generation Indian American. How is that received in India?
Go ahead, Vaman.
Well, we had the former U.S. Vice President who was half Indian American, second generation as well. So I think over a period of time, Indians are now used to the fact that, as I was mentioning earlier as well, that there's an Indian diaspora in the U.S., which is Indian Americans, and they are relatively well-placed and well-doing. I do not think there is any special significance to the fact that, you know, Usha Vance happens to be of Indian descent, because that doesn't really sort of qualify for anything in terms of U.S.-India relationship. It's just a testament that Indian Americans happen to be a hugely successful community, and hence perhaps is also a reason why there should be more visas for skilled people, skilled immigration into the U.S., to sort of fill in those gaps where the United States sort of perhaps does not produce enough number of people to fill in such jobs or specialized skills. So I think I'd sort of, you know, stop at that.
Yeah, well, I think there is a nice warm feeling to see that, you know, people of Indian origin are doing so well. There is that. But I think at the same time, there's a clear understanding that they are, after all, U.S. politicians, U.S. leaders, and they will act in the U.S. interest. But they do form a kind of cultural bridge with the home country, which we welcome.
We'll see, since I guess the Vice President and his wife are on their way to India in the coming month, right?
That's so right.
All right. Well, that's a great place to let this thing go. We want to thank both of you, Ambassador Prasad, Vaman. We want to thank you both for joining us today, and we hope to have you back. And our guests today, as well as my co-host, all are advisors with Bauer Group Asia, which is our sponsor. Bauer Group is a strategic advisory firm that specializes in the Indo-Pacific. It applies unmatched expertise and experience to help clients navigate the world's most complex and dynamic markets. And I think we covered the fact that India is indeed a complex and dynamic market. And so if you are going to do business in India, you probably would like to have a guide. And Bauer Group is a great guide. As I said, my co-host Jim Caruso is a senior advisor with Bauer Group, as were both of our guests. You can visit them at bauergroupasia.com. So Jim, indeed, quite the announcement coming out of that summit last month. And really, it does kind of stand alone in it was very forward-looking. It was very detailed. It was just sort of remarkable that this new administration just came in and there's all this chaos around it, and yet they have this one summit that just seems to go perfectly.
Well, we all know that President Trump is big on personal relationships, and he likes Prime Minister Modi, and apparently the Prime Minister likes him. And so, huge trade deficits notwithstanding, they're going marching forward. I also wonder, as it was alluded to during our conversation, the number of influential corporate CEOs of Indian extraction in the U.S. Microsoft, Google, Micron, Pepsi, all have Indian Americans as their CEOs.
No.
And as we know, President Trump 2.0 really likes tech and CEOs. So I wonder if there's any nexus there.
Well, it wasn't just the fact that they got along great, but they were ready for this, right? I mean, they had quite the punch list of objectives. So they came into this, And again, this was, you know, less than a month after the inauguration, when most of their team is not yet in place, and there's turmoil in the Pentagon, and there's turmoil at state and the National Security Council. And yet they went into this one knowing, apparently knowing what they wanted. And I don't think all of that, you know, came from the old team or from the Indian side. I think some of it probably came from the new administration and things that people in that team came into the administration wanting.
Yes. And again, I'm thinking part of it is because the big corporate tech bros know the importance of India, see it as a alternative to China, and 1.4 billion consumers can't be wrong.
They cannot be. All right. Well, I tell you what, let me regale you. I don't have a really good India story since they denied me entry. I didn't get a decent story this year.
Maybe that's why.
Well, I think it was my association with you, but
never.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that didn't work out. I went and did the e-visa this time, and that's supposed to make everything easier. Because the old one was like this old fashioned paper visa and which is email, but the e-visa went in, and like 2 days before the trip was supposed to go, I just get something back and said denied.
Apparently the e stood for exclude.
Yeah, they didn't say why, you know, I had no idea what the problem was, but I was denied, so there. But I'll tell you, let's see. So I'm going to go back a few years and tell you an Army story. So, of course, I'm an Air Force guy. I went to the Command and General Staff College back about 20 years ago, which is an Army staff college at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Yes, the same place where they have the federal penitentiary. I was not in the penitentiary. I was at the staff college. And I was surrounded by soldiers, Army soldiers. So I was, you know, one of the token Air Force guys, and I came in for my share of, you know, off-color comments and those kinds of things that the Air Force earns from the Army, because we're the ones that get to stay in the nice hotels and have better golf courses. But as we were having a discussion one day, it was all around the issue of logistics. And I had just returned from a deployment to Iraq, and it was in the fairly early days of the war there. And when I deployed from Ramstein Air Base in Germany, and I was issued a 9mm weapon at Ramstein Air Base, and I had to lock it in this case, take it to Frankfurt, and in order to board a plane through Frankfurt Airport, to you know, from a first leg of my flight to Iraq. So, you know, imagine you're in Germany and you're trying to explain that I'm here and I've got a gun in this thing, right? But this is the way you do it. And it was, and of course, then you get through the whole thing, and the whole thing is a pain because you have to sort of declare everything and there's paperwork. And so I just had the simple question for my Army friends there in my class. Isn't there a way you could just pre-stage all of this? I mean, we've been in Iraq a little while now. You know, it hadn't been a terribly long time, but long enough so that if you wanted to just put a bunch of weapons there, and then you show up and you fall in and they issue you a weapon when you get there. It seemed reasonable to me, but I'm an Air Force guy. So across the room, my friend Shane, a Special Forces officer, looks at me and he says in his deep Southern accent, "Ray, it's like this, you see. Why don't you come to my house for dinner tonight, but you don't got to bring your own wife. I'll issue you one when you get there." Ah. So I didn't ask about weapons anymore.
That's a really disturbing story to read.
Got a little bit of a culture clash, shall we say.
Yeah.
Okay. The whole year was like that.
So you were the round peg.
Well, exactly. Well, you know, I was like an exchange officer. So, all right. Well, we would never exchange our producer, Ian Ellis Jones, who does a great job for us. He and IEJ Media put out our podcast, which of course is produced by IEJ Media. He also does some fantastic geopolitical graphics, which I continue to run into in the most interesting of places. So you want to follow him on X, at Ian Ellis Jones, all one word. If you like this episode, we have several other India focused episodes. They remain some of our most popular. And you can go to YouTube, of course, youtube.com/IP podcast, or you can do any of the audio streaming services, Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any of those. Episode 16 was Why Should We Care If India Becomes the World's Third Largest Economy? And that particular episode became the most watched YouTube video we've ever done by a pretty big margin. Episode 25 was Why Should We Care If India Is Deprioritizing Its Navy? And episode 39 was Why Should We Care About India's Strategic Autonomy? So some great India content out there. If you'd like to get more of it, it all remains very, very relevant. Finally, if you want to email us and you've got particular questions or comments, we have an email address. That's indopacificpodcast@gmail.com. That's indopacificpodcast@gmail.com. That is the best way to get sort of your point across if there's something specific you think we should be paying attention to. So finally, we want to once again thank our great sponsor, Bauer Group Asia. Find them at bauergroupasia.com. For Jim and Ian, I'm Ray. Join us next time on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.